fellow Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the host of the show, and normally you would be hearing the music right about now. But before we get started, I wanted to just let you know, when you listen to this episode, you're going to hear our pal and NPR's London correspondent, Ari Shapiro. We don't mention the thing that you might have heard about Ari since we taped this, which is that in the fall, he's going to be newly a co-host of All Things Considered, which is great news, but we don't mention it. So don't feel like it's weird. It's just because we didn't know. So enjoy the show. Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. On this week's show, we're mixing music and film and hoping for some toe tapping, some orchestra swelling, and a reminder of what the best movie music can do. So don't go away.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? It kind of does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. Whether you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find How to Do Everything now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We've got music and movies busting out all over this week, but before we get started, let's go around the table here in historic Studio 44. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Bob Mondello, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movie critic for All Things Considered.
And with us this week in the country for once is the lovely Ari Shapiro. Ari, what do you do at NPR when you're not doing this? Nothing important. Right?
I'm an international correspondent based in London, and I feel like I'm back with my dysfunctional family who I love for Thanksgiving.
That's right. That's how we feel, too. Well, we're always happy to have Ari with us, and when we realized that we were going to have Ari here and Bob here and Steven here, it seemed like we needed to do something...
gay.
Boom. It seemed like we needed to do something music and film oriented. So we decided that we would start off by talking a little bit about the state of music in movies. Now, I was looking at a list on Billboard.com by a guy named Dan Riley, who put together a list of the 50 top songs from movies on the Billboard charts. And what I learned from this is how many really unexceptional pop songs had completely forgotten were associated with movies. Whether it's your ones that people remember a little bit more, like Eye of the Tiger, you know, from Rocky III. But you've also got, like, for example, Two Hearts by Phil Collins from Buster.
from the unforgettable cinema classic Buster,
which I don't think very many people remember.
I've not seen the list.
Although they might remember the Phil Collins song. Number one on this list, number one on the Billboard charts for 10 weeks is, of course, You Light Up My Life by Debbie Boone. Which, of course, is it a terribly memorable movie?
You light up my life.
Well, I used
Bob breaks the seal on singing. How many of us will sing in this episode?
My sister and I both used to be able to play that on the piano. She in particular, but that's...
No, so this is 1978. What is the movie?
It's You Light Up My Life.
The movie is You Light Up My Life.
Did you remember that was a movie?
No,
and she's in it, right?
I had to advertise it. I was in advertising back then for a chain of film theaters. And I thought, this is the stupidest movie. It's about a woman who sings a song.
You worked in advertising for movie theaters?
So long.
He sure did.
So long ago
that I did not know that was a movie.
This used to be a thing, right? Like, you would have, you know, stuff like Beverly Hills Cop 2 had Shakedown by Bob Seger.
So good.
That used to be a thing. Like, you would have a big movie and... it would just have to have, you know, like Mannequin has Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now by Starship. Yep. It was just a like you put out a totally unexceptional movie and there would be like a pop song.
If you look at the top 10 best-selling soundtrack albums of all time, I mean, the number that are from like 1978 to 1992, which is the 80s. It's a remarkable number. I mean, I haven't done a count, so I'm going to do this while I'm talking, but Footloose, I mean, Forrest Gump is like 94, Lion King is like 94, Top Gun is 80s, Purple Rain is 80s, Grease is, you know, 70s, Titanic, Dirty Dancing, Saturday Night Fever, and the best-selling soundtrack of all time by a mile, The Bodyguard.
I was just going to mention The Bodyguard.
So number two, there are several with like 28 million. Number one with more than 40 million is The Bodyguard.
And how many of those are because of the one mega hit pop song that Linda's referring to?
Right.
And how many are because this was a brilliantly curated soundtrack?
This is the moment in time when singles were not a thing. When
people were singles.
I bought cassette singles in the 80s.
But what I'm saying is singles as a sales force were much less of a thing during the cassette period because they just didn't take off as much as they had when it was LPs. You had more singles. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the CD stuff was the same way, but then eventually you got into what we have now, which is digital singles and people getting songs individually. But at that time, at the time that, like, the Bodyguard soundtrack came out, if you wanted to own that song, you would buy the album. That was what people did. And I think you're exactly right that a lot of those are the result of really just one song. There are exceptions to that. Top Gun has a handful of hits. Mm-hmm. Footloose has a handful of hits. Yeah. Sometimes they just got lucky over and over again. Saturday Night Fever has a lot and is essentially a Bee Gees album, right?
Right.
Like, as opposed to being a typical.
In Footloose, you occasionally will hit a scene in the movie where you're like, I don't know this song. Mm-hmm. And it's weird.
Yeah.
And then there are the films that have popular soundtracks where they are not mega pop hits. It's just a really well-curated playlist. I mean, you know, a more recent example of that was Garden State, but an older example of that was Rain Man, which I wore out on cassette and which was referenced in a Kimmy Schmidt episode.
Wow, the soundtrack of Rain Man. Yeah. What's on the soundtrack?
Oh, Iko Iko One Day.
Iko Iko One Day.
Okay, so now I've sung. Two down, two to go.
Yeah, I don't think that counted.
Take the kiss away.
Okay.
That didn't
Linda,
count.
Linda, we're down to you. And then there's all the music that's written for movies, like every Danny Elfman soundtrack to every Tim Burton film. I don't know if anybody actually buys that soundtrack, but you certainly can't think of the movie without thinking of the music that goes with it.
Right. No, that's true. And I think we're in such a blockbuster age, right? We're in the age of these gigantic blockbuster films, but you don't have the kinds of really, I don't always like the word iconic, but I think in this case it fits, the iconic soundtracks from like Star Wars and the Superman movie, Indiana Jones, and all all of this John Williams stuff.
Just try singing the theme from Interstellar or Avatar. Like, can anyone?
Yeah. Well, Interstellar, I think it's just a grinding noise, isn't it?
Well, and there's the famous, like, Inception, blah. they're much more feely. Like, they're not so themey.
Well, Ari brought up the point of Garden State, which I think is a really interesting example of a kind of soundtrack. And frankly, a kind of soundtrack that I find interesting. I mean, Garden State, that soundtrack is the soundtrack to the coming of age for a lot of people of just a certain age group.
Duh.
The Shins and Iron and Wine doing such great heights and this kind of touchy-feely early aughts, you know, just like sensitive music.
Or like 500 Days of Summer is another perfect example of that.
Right, with a little bit of Hall & Oates mixed in.
Right.
You know? Now, what I wonder, like within the last few months, I have watched like kind of back-to-back a number of movies where Randall Poster was the music supervisor. And Randall Poster is like the music supervisor. He does virtually any recent soundtrack you can name. Anything that involves a curated collection of...
Give me some examples.
Okay, Whip It.
Okay.
He did the sound, which is a great soundtrack.
Right.
He's really good. Randall Poster's terrific at his job.
Yeah.
School of Rock.
Okay.
Now, that has some original songs written for it that are incorporated into the music. But it's gotten to the point where I can almost sense, like, boy, the music in this is expertly selected. I bet it's Randall Poster.
Not because it's a particular sound, but just because of the skill with which it's chosen.
Because, and that's the thing. Like, he has a sound as far as, like, this is impeccably curated, but it's not always really getting you into the specific feel of a movie. It's just somebody who's really good at picking music.
It's so funny. I'm used to thinking of this in terms of movies that are about the past and that you curate a soundtrack of old hits that are designed to evoke a certain period. And you know, someone like Cameron Crowe does that all the time and does it really specifically and does it really wrong a lot of the time. I mean, the song doesn't match up. But I sit next to Mark Jenkins, who is a music expert, and he knows about the music of all that era. And he's always saying, well, that song wasn't until 2 years later or something like that. And I'm thinking, oh, well, who cares? It's the era. But I'm used to thinking of that as sort of wallpaper for a period designed to make you feel like you're back there. There's a picture that is just coming out, Love and Mercy, that is about the Beach Boys, where there's a lot of that kind of music that is there in addition to the Beach Boys hits that you expect from the film. And you think all the time about the music. You're just constantly thinking about what's playing.
Yeah. it borders on pastiche sometimes, mm-hmm. depending on the movie. Mm-hmm. There's a really, what I feel, and people on Twitter, every time I say this, agree with me, very underrated movie called Grace of My Heart. That
if people on Twitter agree with you, it must be true.
That Ileana Douglas plays a woman who's essentially based on and very much like Carole King. So there's a lot of music in the movie that is made to sound like old Carole King songs or old songs that she was writing for people like girl groups and stuff like that. Recently, when Leslie Gore died, one of the things people talked about was this performance by Bridget Fonda as this very modeled on Leslie Gore singer who did this song called My Secret Love, which is in the film about the woman she was in love with.
You and I, we are like spies in the house of holy love.
It is the most Leslie Gore sounding song in the world, and it was co-written by Leslie Gore. So a lot of these people came in, helped work on the movie. There's a what's supposed to sound like kind of a classic Burt Bacharach-y kind of song that he worked on. So it's it's a great example of kind of setting period through music in that way that you're talking about. And I think what Stephen was saying about the use of soundtracks to kind of sum up an era, it's like the same thing, whether you're doing it in a period way or you're doing it in like the Reality Bites soundtrack is the same way. Mm-hmm. It is that, like, it's that time period
soundtrack.
In this little... Yeah. In this little box. And they even did it, like, it's much more rare with television, but they did a soundtrack for Friends, which is essentially the same. It's just trying to be the big bag of that time.
You know, even though the soundtrack is more rare for television, I feel like television makes songs into breakthroughs far more than movies
now did. Now it does.
I mean, Girls alone. The gays were dancing to Robin Dancing on My Own for years before suddenly it was featured in an episode of Girls, and then it was huge. Same thing with Icona Pop. I love it.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, well, and that has applied to some really kind of cool music, and it's also applied to some kind of what I would think of as the adult contemporary kind of genre, a lot of which has gotten a lot of exposure on stuff like Grey's Anatomy and things like that. I mean, Grey's Anatomy has broken a bunch of bands.
Oh, yeah. Grey's Anatomy for a while was a harbinger of a lot. And you also, of course, you have the songs that show up at the end of the dramatic scene of every crime procedural for a while. You can carbon date crime procedurals to the tune of Hallelujah, the Jeff Buckley version of Hallelujah.
Which was then replaced by the Rufus Wainwright version, which was then replaced by...
Yeah, it's true.
We've talked about transatlanticism on this show before, about how like 6 Feet Under has that really memorable montage set to, you know, set to it. But there are certain songs that keep coming up over and over.
There's one show from my youth that they've never released an album for. It's Harold and Maude.
That's
all Cat Stevens, right?
Right, it's all Cat Stevens, but the big song, If You Want to Be Free, I can sing this. If you want to be free, be free.
If you want to sing out, sing out.
See?
There's a million ways to be.
So we all know it, but the song wasn't released as a single.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, had to watch the movie 15 times to get it.
Yep, done and done.
So I did.
Yeah. One of the things that I noticed as I was going over this great Billboard list, and thanks again to them for kind of helping me kick this off, but the disappearance of regular straight-up theme songs like Ghostbusters and 9 to 5 and To Sir With Love.
Mm.
I think the only place that they remain is Bond films.
Interesting.
I think the only place it's still like the Adele Skyfall and stuff like that. They still do it.
Which tend to be big pop hits.
Oh, and those still sound like.
Well, they're marketed.
It's also a nice shortcut to at least being considered for Oscars.
Yeah.
Well, like,
I'm always surprised that there aren't more
Disney pictures.
I mean, Disney pictures, definitely. But, like, you don't necessarily have, like, San Andreas.
I can just picture the 80s hair rock band song.
I just picture, like Chad Kroeger from Nickelback, like, bellowing the love theme from San Andreas.
Right. No, absolutely. And you kind of wind up, like, theme songs feel so cheesy. Like, that's why, like, one of my running jokes on Twitter is that I write theme songs for
that's
TV
how
shows.
Hot mom, mom, cop.
Like stupid theme songs for TV shows because it feels like such a cornball thing to do. So the idea of an actual theme song with the title of the show or movie in it is just, aside from Bond movies.
I would expect like Paul Feig or somebody to bring that back.
Right. Maybe there is one coming up, you know?
I think if anybody is going to buy the soundtrack of a show today, it's going to be a TV show, whether that's Glee or Smash Nashville. Or Nashville or Empire. Yep. Those are the soundtracks that are actually selling.
Right.
Well, except for the Disney pictures.
Yeah. Right. But it's, when Stephen talked about the Oscars, it's interesting to me that everybody seems to have kind of seeded the song category. You know, everybody has kind of given that up to
animated movies.
Yeah. And it used to be like that you would get some of these goofball songs like Maniac and stuff like that. And those kind of, I mean, and I'm talking here not so much about straight up musicals, but movies that were faux musicals like Flashdance was and a little bit like Footloose was, where it was heavily based around the music. My typical mix of best song choices now, what I envision is like three Disney songs and then something from some Swedish documentary where someone knew the guy.
There's an Enya song in a fantasy film.
Right. Sure. Exactly. But I feel like they don't write songs to be event songs anymore, except for Disney, obviously, and Bond films.
Yeah. And when you watch a lot of those 80s movies, like I watched Top Gun within the last couple of years, and it's almost as if large elements of that movie are just music video. And the music is so integral to that movie. It's just a part of why people attach to it.
I think Quentin Tarantino still does that. I think music is really important to his films, and whether it's original music or recognizable from elsewhere music.
And Django has a theme song, I think.
Yeah,
doesn't
it?
Like an actual theme song.
Django! Django, have you always
It's a kind of a little bit ironic distancing kind of
I was
thing.
Really glad that Bob mentioned Harold and Maude, because that is a perfect example of a kind of movie soundtrack and an approach to music in movies that I really love and gravitate to, which is having one artist.
I know exactly what you're going to talk about.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Provide kind of a narrative through line and almost serve as like the conscience and voice of the movie. So Simon and Garfunkel in The Graduate, it can make an icon of both the artist and the movie. Something as silly as Jonathan Richman in There's Something About Mary, where he's standing on the street performing the songs that are playing throughout the movie. And like, for one thing, it's lovely because it gave this huge platform to Jonathan Richman, who was not a mainstream artist. It gives a real personality to the movie in a way that it wouldn't necessarily have. And I always want more of that. I always want...
You didn't mention the one I thought you were going to mention.
Which one?
Dan in Real Life.
Oh, yeah. Sandra Lerca in Dan in Real Life, in what I think is is an underrated movie, which many people hate.
The Steve Carell film, Dan in Real Life, which Sandra Lerca does a whole bunch of songs in that movie.
And not only do the Sandra Lerca songs pop up throughout the soundtrack, there is like a triumphant performance at one point where Sandra Lerca actually is there performing his own stuff.
And there's a bunch of really cool stuff in the movie. There's a cover of Elvis Costello's Human Hands in that movie that Sandra Lerca did that I really love.
And Lerca's a very, very charming singer with a charming voice that is exactly capturing the slightly twee.
But ultimately lovable.
But ultimately lovable tone that movie is going for.
Explains why you like it. Sick burn!
I want that more in movies. And with a lot of my favorite singers, I always think somebody should just make that singer the voice of that movie.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Well, I would be interested to hear from people about your favorite songs from movies. I have a feeling people are going to say you didn't mention.
How did you not mention the Cocktail soundtrack?
My favorite soundtrack, my favorite song from a movie. So come and find us on Facebook or on Twitter and tell us what you think. When we come back, we're going to talk about movie adaptations of musicals and why some of them succeed and some of them, as your favorite theater person will tell you, do not. So we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Frank from Santa Barbara, California. Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and this message comes from Blue Apron, the new service that delivers all the ingredients you need to make incredible meals at home. Farm fresh ingredients are perfectly proportioned and come with an easy to follow recipe card, so you can create a delicious meal in 35 minutes or less. You'll cook meals like a Mexican style chicken torta with tomato, avocado, and cucumber salad. Discover a better way to cook. Visit blueapron.com/pop to get your first two meals free. That's blueapron.com/pop.
Welcome back. When we were last with you a couple of minutes ago, we were talking about music in film, but now we are going to go to the straight up film adaptation of stage musicals. These tend to be, in my experience, and I don't know whether Ari or Bob in particular would agree or disagree, but I tend to find that with most movie adaptations, theater people do not like them and look at them kind of askance.
Yeah, but with most movie adaptations of books, book people do not like them and look
that
at them
true.
Askance.
That is absolutely true.
I'm not
true.
Sure that necessarily says that empirically the films are inferior.
No, that's true.
Just
that's
as a theater snobs are snobs.
But they are. They're inferior, almost invariably. I can think of one that I think it was an improvement on the Broadway original, which is Cabaret, where they cast it right. And they made sense of things that hadn't really worked on stage.
Yeah.
But also, he changed it in really dramatic
Bob
ways.
Newsflash, Bob applauds Liza Minnelli.
That's not what I meant. She was almost miscast because she's so good. And it's clear that she would be a star. And she's not that character
right.
can't be a star. And we can go on for hours about this. But I think Cabaret.
You could go on for hours about this.
Steven. But what's nice about that show and the reason it kind of works as a film is that the music that they're singing is largely on stage. And so he cut most of the songs that were not. The subsidiary characters in that who have songs outside of the Cabaret had their songs cut.
Yeah.
And so the show kind of works because Fosse rethought it. But ordinarily, what they try to do is not to rethink it, but to put it in a big movie context. And that just means everything gets bigger. If you take a Hello Dolly or a MAME or something like that, the production numbers are suddenly all parades. And it's just big and endless and gargantuan and not interesting.
No, it's true.
I think it's somewhat beside the point to say which is better, but I do think there are good movie adaptations of musicals that you can point to. And often those are musicals where the singing takes place on stage because that works better in a film than a character just breaking into song, like Dreamgirls.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was
mm-hmm.
great. And it was well cast with Beyonce and Jennifer Hudson. I thought in the same way Chicago as a movie musical worked because he made those songs something that made sense as songs.
Right.
In a different way, this is not an adaptation of a stage musical, but I remember years ago when Moulin Rouge was coming out and people said, this is a huge risk, and if it is successful, we will see a flood of movie musicals that we haven't seen in decades. And it was successful partly because it took such creative risks, mixing up pop and show tunes and songs that didn't necessarily mesh with each other, revamped in new ways, Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor singing on top of an elephant. It wasn't afraid to do the ridiculous that occasionally bordered on the sublime.
But it wasn't an adaptation of a stage musical.
Singing
in the Rain is great, too. I mean, if you do a screen musical, yes, it can be fabulous, and I absolutely get that.
Okay,
but when you take a stage musical and you try to adapt it, you have a different set of problems. I mean, I think Once did it brilliantly. Once went the other way.
Went the other way.
So if there's any lesson here, it's that you can't be handcuffed to the stage musical.
Right,
I think another one that was really successful was Sweeney Todd, which to me looked much more like the horror that the stage musical was always meant to be once it was on film and you were really in the face of the blood and gore.
I didn't think the performances were everything they could have been. I think that Tim Burton did all the things that you'd want him to do.
Yeah.
And if he'd had great voices in it, it would have been even more spectacular.
So we're specifically talking about stage-to-screen adaptations. I mean, isn't a lot of what we're talking about the weight of expectations?
It is, but I also think that there's something to what Bob and Ari are saying about the fact that it depends on the kind of show. And I think that, for example, I think the film of West Side Story, as much as a lot of people have mixed feelings about some of the performances in that movie, some are awesome, I think some are not as awesome. But that movie benefits a lot from the fact that it has so much dancing. And so I think when you have something that has so much kind of high quality, important dancing that is done by people who are great dancers, there's more to do with kind of the use of screen than if you have a musical like Oklahoma, right? Which has dancing some of some kinds at some times, but it's not as foregrounded. And so what you tend to get in a movie like Oklahoma is a lot of kind of people standing around singing, which gets a little bit...
It gets cornball.
It does get cornball.
It's very strange. I mean, listen, it's strange on stage, but at least stage is a presentational form where you expect people to have soliloquies and things like that.
Right.
In movies, which are essentially realistic, it's very weird to have somebody bursting into song. And so you have to find excuses to have them burst into song. song, and the easiest excuse is to put them on a stage and have them burst into song.
Yeah, and I think one of the ones that Bob and I have talked about several times over the last year or so is the adaptation of The Last 5 Years that came out earlier this spring that Anna Kendrick and Jeremy Jordan are in. And that on stage, I did not see it, but as I understand it, was very, very bare bones on stage. There was not a lot to the staging of that show. And in the movie, you sort of have no choice but to kind of stage it in reality. Mm-hmm. The premise of that show is that you have the story of a relationship and its end told by the two people who are in it, and they tell it separately. And I think that's one of the themes, is that everyone has a different story of what happens in a relationship that ends. The stage musical didn't really put them in each other's scenes, except at one critical point.
Right.
But other than that, they are alone. And in the movie, they're together kind of regularly all throughout, which made it hard for me, to be perfectly honest. The show has a kind of a complex structure where her songs go from end to beginning and his go from beginning to end, and they cross over in the middle. I knew it was out of order, but I didn't necessarily pick up that structure because they don't separate the songs enough to me, or else I was just like not that bright that day.
I think that's a really strong possibility.
Yeah, me too. But one of the things that's interesting that that movie makes me think about, if I go back and forth between even the soundtrack that they released for the movie and the movie, you realize that when you take a stage show of any kind, and this is really exaggerated with such a simple stage show, every directorial choice that you make adds something to the meaning of song and scene and stuff like that. There is a moment in this particular film where he is singing about basically his fundamental argument in the marriage, which is that he is successful and she is less successful and she resents it, right? Which I think if you watch the whole thing is probably a fair knock on her, at least to some degree. But in the film, when he is singing that on stage, he would just be singing it and you would hear it coming from him. In the film, he is singing it and she is foregrounded. Anna Kendrick is in the scene and in front, right in front of the camera, looking shattered by the fact that he is saying this to her. And so it completely changes how you process that. Instead of him kind of getting to make that point himself, you process it through her. So every directorial choice that you make fusses around in some way with the meaning of the stage musical.
Yeah, totally.
And that example really runs counter to the trend in movie musicals, where typically a filmmaker will take the old chestnut that everybody knows, it's been around for 20 years or more and has a built-in fan base that is enormous, and release it with lots of fanfare on Christmas Day. The Last 5 Years is a pretty niche musical with a very small, albeit devoted, fan base. And so for Anna Kendrick to step into a vehicle like that, it's very different from Les Miserables starring every bold-faced name you've ever seen in a film.
Yeah, the point that you're making also goes to the fact that even when they're flawed, one of the functions of film adaptations of musicals is that they give people an opportunity to see, even if it's a flawed version, a version of a stage show that they wouldn't otherwise have gotten a chance to see. Yeah. I think everybody's got an opinion of how these different performances are different from the ones on stage and how effective the movie is. But even if it's flawed, the music in it is wonderful and the show is wonderful. And there's a lot in there that I think is incredibly moving. And a lot more people have a chance to see it when you can rent it on demand at home.
And the fact is, the production of that show that most people will have the opportunity to see, whatever the show we're talking about happens to be, is not going to be a production with a 25-piece orchestra and extraordinarily talented actors.
For a lot of people, the choice is see a movie that has flaws or see a version of the show that has flaws.
But you can see a movie that has enormous flaws sometimes.
Oh,
I mean, I'm thinking of Man of La Mancha. Wasn't that Peter O'Toole and Sophia Loren?
I have not seen that one, I will confess.
Oh, my God. I mean, neither of them can sing at all. That was a show that really required somebody who could sort of put across to dream the impossible dream. And it just like,
can I have a reality check? Was the 1980s Rick Moranis film of Little Shop of Horrors actually great, or did I just watch it at an impressionable age?
Because that was the age you were at.
No. That was so much fun. Come on.
It was fun. But they changed the ending, right?
Yeah.
Yes, they did. And there was no Don't Feed the Plant finale, as there is in the stage version.
Right. And that's the other thing that I think sometimes happens, is that you do get a certain amount of bowdlerizing of the content of musicals sometimes.
Side note, I met my husband doing a Yale College production of Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, that's the best thing
fantastic.
Ever. That is wonderful. I think I have done my rant before. I know I have done my rant before about Marlon Brando singing in scare quotes in Guys and Dolls. But one of the other things about that show is that they took a couple of the best songs out of that show and replaced them with other songs, which is a thing that they used to do to, I guess, give people who liked the show a reason to see it. Like, wouldn't you like to see this except without some of your favorite songs from it and with some other stuff that we threw in? But I will give this to Marlon Brando in particular. At least he sang for himself.
And I'll know long before we can speak. I'll know in my heart. I'll know, and I won't ever ask. Am I right? Am I wise? Am I smart? But I'll stop and I'll stare at that face. In the throne.
Because one of the things that people often don't know when they complain about movie musicals now, people are auto-tuned or whatever, they're sweetened. It used to be you just didn't sing for yourself at all.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. And if you were...
Which you were a woman, you were Marnie Nixon.
I was going to say, the lovely Marnie Nixon who sang for...
Deborah Carr
in The King and I.
Natalie Wood
in West Side Story. And Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady.
Although, wait, those are all Audrey the same Hepburn voice. Sing Moon River or am I about to get shattered?
No, it wasn't Audrey Hepburn.
Aww. One of the things that's interesting is there is old video of Audrey Hepburn trying the singing in My Fair Lady. And she's like Marlon Brando singing in Guys and Dolls. She's not a great singer, but at least
I'm imagining
it's her.
Audrey Hepburn sounding like Marlon Brando.
No, but I mean, she's not a great singer, but it's her, and it's recognizably her. And when I watched it, I believe she's doing Wouldn't It Be Loverly. There's tape that goes around. You know, it would have been interesting, different, because it's not as pretty as having Marnie Nixon do it, but it was her.
Yeah, I think coming out the same year as Mary Poppins, though, they couldn't have a Julie Andrews-like voice.
Well, they had already passed over Julie Andrews, so you got to at least get someone good.
You know, another movie musical that really works, and I think it's because it was created and written by the person who created the stage production, is Hedwig and the Angry Inch, now running on Broadway in a revival of the off-Broadway show from about 15 years ago. John Cameron Mitchell wrote the show, starred in the show, directed the movie, I think wrote the screenplay for the movie, and starred in the movie as well.
That is one that did not become Grease, like, as a movie. It just kind of floats around and is constantly being redone. And there are times when I look at Grease and I say, do you deserve this? I mean, I think that the John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John Grease, although it is, again, very different from the stage show in a bunch of ways, and many of the most famous songs are not from the stage show, I think that is a very funny, silly, fun movie. Do I look at it and say, like, I'm happy that this is, like, what people think of when they think of musicals?
Yeah.
I don't know. And I think some of the ones that have gotten the worst reputation are the film adaptations of some of our most popular and beloved
stage shows. Chorus Line.
Oh, Chorus Line's terrible.
Yeah.
That's a terrible movie. And a lot of them are kind of like, there's so many that fall into that like fair to middling. Like, if you've never seen The Music Man and you see the movie, that's cool. A lot of stuff comes across. Would you be better off seeing a wonderful stage performance? Probably. You know, the same true of like Carousel and stuff like that. But a lot of them kind of fall into that mushy middle part. But it seems like it's going to be Grease forever because now they're making it again for television with Julianne Hough and Vanessa Hudgens.
That's Is that going to be a live production the way they did Peter Pan and Sound
of
Music?
I forget. I think so, yes. I think it's not NBC this time, though. This one, I think, is Fox. And it's, Julianne Hough, who apparently is now our go-to because she also took over in Footloose.
But also, The Wiz is coming to live television.
That is
which
correct.
Makes me so excited.
That is absolutely true. And much less of the casting is done for that one, but I'm...
Oh, so I still have a chance?
You too. Absolutely. Once again, I would be happy to hear about all of your favorite film adaptations of musicals. And if you have original screen musicals, as Bob was talking about, that is a whole different kettle of fish on which we could have spent a whole nother hour and a half.
You could have.
I could have.
Linda, still three out of the four of us have sung during this recording.
I was going to say.
I don't have anything.
We've mentioned 25 musicals. Pick your favorite.
I have nothing to say.
Wait, give us a few bars of Summer Days. Grease. Come on.
I know. That's okay. When we come back, we will be moving on to our favorite segment. What is making us happy this week? We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? He kind of does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. Whether you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find How to Do Everything now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We have arrived at our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? I'm going to start with Ari Shapiro. Ari, what is making you happy this week?
I literally had planned to say one thing, and then I was on my way to the studio, stopped to say hello to a producer friend of mine at Weekend Edition, and spotted on the giveaway book pile Amitav Ghosh's novel Flood of Fire, which, for those not in the know, is the third novel in a trilogy that he started writing about a decade ago. It's historical fiction based on an event I had never even heard of until I read the first book in the trilogy, Sea of Poppies, The Opium Wars, in which basically, and this is loose, the UK said to Indian farmers, you have to stop growing food that will feed yourselves and instead start growing opium poppies so we can sell drugs to China. And then China said, stop making all of our people addicted to drugs. And Britain said, we're going to go to war with you so we can keep selling your people drugs. It's this amazing trilogy, at least the first two of the three parts are. And the third part, Flood of Fire, has just landed in my hands, and I can't wait to start reading it.
That's making Ari supremely happy this week. Thank you very much, Ari Shapiro. Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Well, in preparation for this talk about musicals, I actually watched a number on television that I just could not resist because I must have seen it 100 times ages ago. It's from a movie called The Gang's All Here. It is a number by Carmen Miranda. This makes me so happy. It is the most phallic number in the history of Busby Berkeley musicals. It involves about 100 chorines running at each other with 6-foot bananas. It is the most astonishing thing. And at some point in the middle of it, Carmen Miranda says something like,
what?
No, there's a whole other number later in the show. This is Busby Berkeley doing his first musical in color, in Technicolor, and it is ridiculous. He's got oranges and blues and all this amazing thing. But this number, in the middle of it, Carmen Miranda is carried out by some big muscle man.
Sure.
And she's wearing a black dress that has these enormous peach-sized strawberries sewn onto it. And she says something like, I wonder why everybody looks at me. And then she sings this.
Some people say I dress too gay, but every day I feel so gay. And when I'm gay, I dress that way. Something wrong with that? No. Americanos tell me that my heart is high, because I will not take it off to kiss a guy. But if I ever start to take it off, I hide.
Why hasn't every drag queen that has ever lived done a performance of that very song? Why am I hearing it for the first time?
I'm sure they have.
You have to watch this. You look up is the lady in the Tutti Frutti hat on Google. And
the lady in the Tutti Frutti hat. Google that.
Muy especial, I promise.
Wow. Thank you, Bob Mondello. Stephen Thompson, try to follow that.
Well, this is the thing. We didn't start with me. We usually start with me, but instead Ari and Bob have gone before, mm-hmm. and they both happened to pick the things I was going to talk about.
Big Amitav Ghosh fan, are you?
Big Amitav Ghosh fan.
And Carmen
Miranda. And Tutti Frutti hat.
And a big, lady. And I brought the Tutti, Jessica can vouch for me. I was going to have her play the exact same clip.
Your hat's a little bit Tutti Frutti
today. It's a little Tutti Frutti today. I like to keep it at least that way in spirit. As I've discussed on the show before, I love video games, but only until 1983.
Right.
I find them just needlessly complicated, and often I'm not big into, like, first-person shooters, and a lot of that stuff just doesn't interest me. My kids, however, they love video games, and my son recently got, like, the hot new game for the Wii U called Splatoon. And I'm like, what? And he explains, well, Dad, it's kind of the first game that I'm interested in that is actually a third-person shooter. Splatoon is a game in which your job is to coat everything with paint. And the big boss at the end is called DJ Octavio. So he is an octopus who is also a DJ, as octopi so often are.
Right.
And you would think that the advantage of being an octopus DJ would be the multiple tentacles on multiple
turntables.
Eight turntables and a microphone. But no,
wow.
He only uses two, but he's inside a giant robot making him the Octobot.
What?
He is making
Octobot.
Him, you battle the Octobot King. And
wow.
I assume he's making this up as he's telling me about it, but no, I've seen him play it. It's colorful and silly and goofy, and you're still going around shooting stuff, but it's just so playful and literally colorful, and it's so silly, and it reminds me of all the things that I originally loved about the Atari cartridges of the 1980s. So, Splatoon.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Okay, so what is making me happy this week is a new episode. You know, we talk about podcasts on the show a lot, and we talk about WTF a lot, and therefore I try to stay away from things that we hit a lot, but there is in the WTF feed right now an interview with Sir Ian McKellen, which I thought was exceptional in the sense that it was, for Marc Maron, a different kind of interview. They talk a lot about Shakespeare. They talk a lot about acting. He's not necessarily Marc Maron's most obvious demographic.
Sure.
Which kind of makes it cool and which I enjoyed very much. So despite the fact that it's a little bit of a punt, I'm going to say Sir Ian McKellen on WTF. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC or Steven at IDislikeSteven. You can follow Ari at Ari Shapiro and Bob at Bob_Mondello. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy and our other producer Kiana Fitzgerald at Kiana Fitz. That's KianaFitz. As always, you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now.